Okay, well, thank you for inviting me. I'm not a scientist, but some of my best friends are. I'm a science publisher, but if I was a scientist and I was sitting here in the audience and I would see a science publisher coming up, I'd be very tempted to lynch him. Yes, you should. The fact that nobody is trying to lynch me suggests to me that you actually don't realize the damage science publishing is doing to science. And I want to talk a little bit about that and how far it goes, how deep it goes, how significant the damage is. And then I'll finish with what we think are practical, pragmatic, possible solution, but which will require your participation. So Alain was right, I was a sinner. And I, for a long time, published traditional journals, took the copyright, sell subscription, won't let people look at the papers unless they pay me something extra. And in my pretty ignorant way, because I didn't quite realize how much damage I do, I really slowed the development of science as much as I could. And the more I slowed it, the better money I made, and I sort of continued that way for a while. Together with everybody else, that was the way science publishing did work, and in many ways, that's the way science publishing works today. When the web arrived, everything changed, and just like for all of us, suddenly impossible things become possible and new ideas were being tried. I had a partial conversion. I realized that it's not necessary now for every library to have a journal, copy of a journal, so that the people in the institution go and look up a paper. I realized that one copy of a paper somewhere on a server is enough for the whole world. And that meant that the whole way we publish could change. And the most significant change of that, and the one that could have done most good, was to convert the scheme of publishing so that every article, every research article that's published can be available to absolutely everybody free of charge without any restriction. We needed to make some manipulation of the existing scheme, and I was there at the very beginning. I went to NIH and I proposed the idea which developed into open access. There were a number of other people walking and thinking about that area. And we started, NIH started a repository for open access paper that everybody can go and look without any restriction. I started a publishing machine to publish papers that way, and open access was born. I was the only publisher at that point doing it, there was nobody else. But there were a number of scientists. David Lippmann, who is the guy who invented PubMed and who runs the NCBI in NIH. Harold Varmus, who was at that time the head of NIH, president of NIH, and was incredibly courageous because we all knew we'll be attacked everywhere. Pat Brown and Mike Eisen, both wonderful scientists who were thinking about those issues and came up with many of the ideas, and we all worked together and they were attacked. I was attacked, but I didn't mind. But they were attacked, and they had much more to lose than me. They were attacked by journals, by publishers, by societies, by other scientists, by friends. They thought that they are really going out there to destroy the industry, which is doing so much good for science. And it was significant that nobody seemed to realize that what they were proposing is really important and positive. And I asked many people, why did nobody notice that there is something wrong about papers disappearing behind walls when it's not necessary? And nobody had an answer. And that's why this is the title of my talk, and I hope this moves it forward. Nobody knows. This is the world in which we sort of live. We just don't want to know. It took me a while to realize what a central role science publishing plays in science. And I don't think many of you just quite realize it in your sort of daily life. Because science is nothing without reporting and without reading. Simply cannot happen. Telling what you found and reading what others found is what science is essentially in the center of it. And you gave the whole task with all its controls and the exact complete decision on it to somebody else, to publishers, and abandoned any right to control it. And you don't. Publishers control it, journals control it, and they don't control it for you. They control it for themselves. And on the way, they do a lot of harm, and they know that they do a lot of harm, and they sort of not rushing to change. Now, slowly, they trying to do it. Open access is winning. So open access journals are growing much faster than other journals. Traditional journals are going down slowly. And I think in some years to come, open access will become a universal way. The reason that it's winning is not so much because of individual scientists, but because the founders decided that it's in their interest. So the first people who supported open access were librarians, amazingly, who were prepared to pay, because the open access depends on paying at the beginning of the process, not at the end. There are some costs involved, somebody has to pay for some of it. But at some point, all the major founders said, yes, it's in our interest to do it that way, we're better off that way, the costs are not that significant, and they came on board and they started mandating, so we now have some number of major founders who says, you're not allowed to publish unless it's open access, maybe with some delay, hopefully the whole delay will disappear, but open access is winning. But open access didn't deal with all problems. It only dealt with the problem of access. It's a significant problem. The problem was relatively simple to solve, technically and conceptually, and it took a long time. It took more than 10 years for us to break even and a huge amount of money to actually demonstrate that open access is a viable publishing method. But it works. I want to now talk a little bit about some of the problems that remain that open access didn't touch, that open access is as guilty as closed access in those sins. And I want to later describe you what are the solution we propose, an industrial solution, a strong solution capable of actually dealing with the problem. So I'll start with the first problem, delay. It's bizarre, I can't understand. Life science runs for about 1 year delay. 1 year delay. Some papers take 6 months to come, some papers take a year and a half to come, but in general, simply open access, science publishing runs with 1 year delay. Biology and medicine runs with 1 year delay. For 1 year, you don't know what has been found out because publishers hold it back, including open access publishers. Can't understand why you don't revolt. I can't understand why you are, too much calm. I think, well, there should be demonstration here. I think you should stand in front of publishing houses and says no, not to delay, and not to editors, not to journals. I'll come to that in a moment. Because it's editors and journals that are the reason for the delay. The process, this curious process that produces the delay, is that you send a paper and somebody who is probably not knowledgeable enough to really understand what the paper is about, the editor of a journal. Yes. He may be biologist once upon a time, but not all of them even are that, but he may have some knowledge about something, but the chance that he will actually understand your specific paper are very small. He takes it, and then he starts making decisions that are out of your control. He will invite referees. Sometimes he will tell you who they are, often he won't, so you don't know who they are. And he asks the referees to do something for him, not for you. He is asking the referees to help him to reject your paper. Now the process starts, where he basically, and for many of them, that's really what they are about. You don't quite know what's going on. They send you some bits of the report if they want to, and some other bits if they don't 1, 2, sometimes you get more, sometimes you get less. And the referees effectively work for the editor of a journal. And the reason that he does it, and he does it in that way, is because what's important for a journal is an impact factor. The journal fight is to say, how do I make my impact factor bigger? And the perception is that a bigger impact factor will bring me more money. Impact factor is another great poison of scientific life, and we'll come to that in a moment. We really need to think how to destroy it. We know that nobody reads journals. Once upon a time, people went to libraries and read journals. We don't read journals now. You know, maybe you sometimes open and read the front bit of Nature Science, but really, we read papers. It's very efficient now. You can go, you can search, you can find the things that are interesting to you, and you can, and if you have access to it, if you have a subscription, you can read it. And if it's open access, you can read it without a problem. PubMed has made an experiment, an interesting experiment. They were wondering if when somebody makes a search on PubMed and opens some of the abstracts but not others, is he more likely to open an abstract of a higher ranking journal, a higher impact factor journal than lower impact factor journal? So they made a test and they found that there is zero relationship. There is simply no relationship. The chances of opening a Nature paper or Albanian journal paper are exactly the same. No different. They were so surprised, and nothing against Albania, which is concerned about something, they were so surprised they made the same experiment on a much bigger set, the same. And when you think about it, it's of course it is like that. You find, you have a result, you look through it, you see if it answers the question you've put. If it answers, you open. If it doesn't answer, you don't open. You often don't even know, don't reach the point in which the journal is named. You're looking for an answer, not for a journal. So for readers, journals are not important. The importance of journals is only for authors. And the reason that journals are important for authors is because impact factor decides your future. And so you fight hard to get into one journal or another. Yes, and you know that the journal will delay your publication and that many, many bad things may happen on the way and will not understand and will give trouble, but you will fight and maybe wait for years to try to get into a top-ranking journal. But the paper will be read in the same way. It doesn't matter where it was published. For you as a reader, it makes no difference. For you as an author, it only makes a difference for your career. Otherwise, it makes no difference. You've voluntarily gave up the control of the process to editors, and you did it because of the impact factor, and you permit a secretive process behind your back, to some extent, sometimes less, sometimes more, to do it. The next problem, which exists now, all those problems you all know. I know that I don't tell you anything new, except that you do nothing about it and participate and continue in it, but so the next process is that everybody, I don't know how many people tell me peer review is broken. Peer review is a disaster, peer review is a problem, there's too much of it, it's too much of it, it's not thing we don't know, it's secret, peer review is broken. Peer review is important and peer review is really useful. But peer review is for authors to make the papers better. That's the main reason. The conversation of a referee should be with the author, not with the editor. This is the main reason it's broken. And that's why various strange things can happen. You don't know whether maybe your competitor is now refereeing you and delaying you. You don't know what they say. You don't know exactly what is happening with delay. Something needs to be done. Let's add another placard. Next problem. Where is the data? Where is the data? That now we all probably heard about this various exercises. People try to reproduce sets of papers and discover that 80% of them are irreproducible, 50% of them are irreproducible. What's going on? Is it possible? Can we be sitting now on a piles of irreproducible papers that that may not be true, and what is it for, and why is it happening? Well, it's because the data is hidden. Because people either don't give data, don't want to give data, hide the data, give partial data. I can't understand how referees can referee without the data, but they do. How you can read a paper and in a subject it's specifically for you and know what to do about it if you can't access the data. This problem, it's a really significant problem. It's growing in importance. There are whole groups of committees and declarations and articles, and big shots are writing about it, and big institutions say this must stop. But meanwhile, nothing happens. It's very hard to do. Data is a hard problem to solve, but needs to be solved. Let's finish with impact factor, and then I will come to all the problems, amazingly enough, are solvable. Impact factor was invented by a friend of mine, now retired, wonderful man called Eugene Garfield, who started Current Contents and then Citation Index and then came up impact factor. He's a library scientist. This was invented for libraries to help them to decide which journals to take, how journals connect to each other. There's various other reasons. He never intended it to be the measure of the quality of individual paper or individual scientists. He obviously knows it's completely inappropriate. He hates impact factor. He regrets he's ever invented it. Yeah? But it grows, and its dominance is so horrendous. And it stops everything. You know, it's very hard to start a new journal because nobody wants to publish in a journal that doesn't have an impact factor. But impact factor takes 5 years to get an impact factor. So for 5 years, journals have to struggle and hope and pray that they will survive. It's that changes completely the dynamics of the publishing world. They also very unfairly treat you. You know, you all probably know of completely inappropriate decisions, both for good and for bad, which are based on impact factor analysis. And more than that, you probably all participate. You probably are, some of you, on committees and groups and things where you make a decision whom to give a job or which thing or where to go based on impact factor data, which is not really meaningful. It's so problematic. It's so in so many ways. It has some uses. That to use this as the universal machinery, and now we have there are governments, China will pay people for articles that are published in impact factor above certain amount of money. There are countries that don't permit their scientists to publish in a journal without impact factor. They're forbidden. So they're not allowed to publish it. Think Poland, where I come from, is one of them. We have become slaves, or you have become slaves to the whole machinery, the impact factor and things. And somehow you got used to it and don't object. I'm sure you object in conversation. I'm sure from time to time you say that's no good, but you don't really do anything. And I find it continually. For example, you do not send your paper to a journal that doesn't have an impact factor. You just won't. You won't. And maybe some of the top people will, yes. Alain might, yes. But he will say, I can't ask my people who work with me. It's a disaster for their career. I can't do that. Yeah. And the only reason for it is the impact factor. What can we do? And what we do? So, my partial conversion was the realization how important publishing is for science. And my sense that science is really important, really important. And it is wrong and it is bad for us as publishers to damage it. And we do. So, open access was the first effort that we tried, and I've taken some very significant risk, but tried to do it, and it worked out in the end, and we showed that it's possible. And now we are trying to address all the other deals in some new way. Our organization is called F1000, and we are built, the whole structure, the whole idea, and the basis of the thing is, those photographs can be change from time to time. There are 10,000 faculty members. We started to think that it will be 1,000, but in fact, on the day one, it was 2,400, and we didn't think calling faculty 2,400 would work. So we keep the name Faculty of 1,000, and now we just call it F1,000. There are 10,000 scientists which are self-appointed. Nobody can join it because they want to. There are, some of you probably are faculty members, so you know basically how it works. You are invited. It's built from above in a very similar way that a faculty, that a scientific institution will be built. And we have, for the last few years, every Nobel Prize winner in biology and medicine was already a faculty member. So this is a very high quality group of people. And everything we do is with their support, criticism, suggestions, ideas. We discuss, we think, we work very closely with them. We are about 100 of us. There are about 100 people working in trying to do what we are doing. So we are a small size science publisher. About a quarter of us are developers. It's impossible to do science publishing now. It's all very significant technology. And the technologies work very closely with inventing the publishing products that we try to produce. We have a history of innovation. We always try to do something new. Our normal plan is we want to demonstrate that some new, better method works well enough so that some commercial publisher, somebody will take it away from us and continue, and we can go and do some other new thing. And that's what happened with Biomed Central, the first open access publisher, and that's what one day might happen with what we do now with F1000. We are providing a group of three integrated services, and I'll quickly say a few words about each one of them. Prime, F1000 Prime. Here is a name. Smiling. So that shows that he. What we do here is we ask the faculty members to say, when you come across an interesting paper, rate it. There are three levels of rating, 1 star, 2 star, 3 star, and tell us why it's interesting. We have 160,000 papers have been rated in that way. It's between 1% and 2% of PubMed, of total PubMed literature. This is a qualitative reporting on literature. In some sense, it's opposition to impact factor. It's a direct reporting specific to each paper decided by an individual who is named and explained why. All qualitative ratings, all schemes of that type have many problems, but all of them are to some extent necessary. We need a number of different ones. People can use them in different ways. Many people use the F1000 Prime service to basically be informed of the most interesting papers near to their subject in some systematic way, and it is an effective way to do that. It is a sort of alternative to impact factor, and some people use it. So, for example, Wellcome is using impact factor measurements to measure the success of specific research projects and some other things, and other people do similar things. We have some places which actually consult F1000 when they give funds or jobs or things. The next of the three things is F1000 Research. F1000 Research is a new and very different, and maybe this is the central point to make here. It's a way to publish research articles that copes, that tries to avoid the problems that are on the way. To avoid delay, the first problem I talked to, we published immediately. A paper comes. We have a very efficient technology to deal with it. we have a hygiene check. We say, we look if it's a scientific paper. Does it come from a scientist? Does it come from a scientific institution? Doesn't look like a scientific paper. Does it obey certain basic ethical constraints? And we publish it within a week. So within a week, the paper is published. It looks exactly like a paper. It's citable. It has a DOI. People do cite it. But it's immediately marked awaiting peer review. So we do not publish without peer review. The moment of publishing triggers the peer review. Our peer review works. It's as strict as anybody, and actually, I think, in many ways, stricter. It works in the following way. The author chooses referees. The author chooses referees, but he has to choose them from a list of permitted referees. That list is our faculty. They go and they try to find people within the faculty to ask to referee. If they can't find anybody there, then they suggest some names. We try to make sure that they are sufficient level of expertise, and we add them to the list of referees. We have developed a dynamic citation process which shows from the beginning and exactly what the level of where it is in the process of refereeing, and the refereeing in our case is a process, and it contains both the version number and the referee status. Here is a dynamic citation, and you can see that we say version 3 index means that it passed the refereeing process to a level in which PubMed, another indexing system, listed in PubMed. So the papers are not listed in PubMed immediately. PubMed only lists refereed papers, so they wait for a bit, and as soon as it passes refereeing status, it's published, and you see how it looks. The refereeing status is part of the dynamic citation. The author chose referees. Referees reports come directly to the paper and appear immediately underneath the paper as soon as the referee sends them, with the name and affiliation of the referee, so that the refereeing is completely open, completely transparent. The authors normally immediately respond to the referee's comments openly. Everybody can read them, maybe correct some misunderstanding, maybe explain what they've done, and quite soon afterwards, a new version appears of the paper, where they contain a short explanation of what's new in the version, and the referees see the new version, respond to that, and this process continues until the authors decide they had enough, and it's done, and then the paper stays in that status, but it's never final, it's never unchangeable. There is no reason why the authors may not in 10 years' time decide that something changed significantly, they want to change and produce a new version of the paper, and that's fine. Nothing is removed. All the previous versions, all the comments referees, all the comments of authors, and also comments of readers who are registered within the system and they are scientists and working scientists, all appear as part of the report. The referee's comments get their own DOI and are citable in their own right. Something new has happened here, and it's actually really interesting. Referees' comments, now that they know that they are visible, are very interesting. They often quite significant, they're quite long, they have citations, they are short little reviews. They are cited. And we now have situations in which sometimes papers are found through the citation of the refereeing comment. So referees now, their participation in the process, their contribution to the subject remains, is there and is visible, it's auditable. We demand that every paper provides all the data as far as we can judge on which the paper is based. And we work hard with many different groups to make the data visible in a usable way. We work on many viewers, other people work on many viewers. The data is available, accessible by every reader of the paper, including by the referees, and the referees do look at the data and play with it. We demand the data. Occasionally people don't want to give us the data. Usually we try to persuade them. Usually in the end they agree. If they don't agree, we don't publish. So that's the only way we will not publish, if the users refuse to provide data. We careful with the very specific data issues that may be unavoidable, but in general, we demand that the data is published. We are, of course, a completely open access publisher. Open access is sort of our conviction. We also operate a preprint server as a sort of a posting post, which can have images, illustrations, short comments, other things that is completely free and people put it. We encourage posters to go on preprint server, and we have many posters there. And we also encourage poster authors to say, when you feel you're ready, publish your poster. If you think the work is done and publish it, had it referee, it will be cited. Now we are launching a third part of the scheme. Very important, essential. I encourage you to go, and we're launching at the beginning of May, so in 2 weeks' time. It's worth it. It's a set of tools. We work hard over a number of years, and we've coded and worked. And it's a set of tools for authors to write, for authors, life scientists to write. So we have really fantastic tools. We have a better reference manager than any other reference manager around. We have a better library builder of PDFs than any library builder around. We have an authoring tool that is really wonderful. It's based on Word, and we are adding other based on LaTeX and other authoring tools that make it very easy to write. We have schemes to discover literature, including an automatic way by which, as you write or as you work, references sent to you that algorithmically are thought to be potentially relevant to you. We will have soon a tool that, when the paper is finished, a more heavy-duty tool, it will read the paper, will think carefully, and will say, I think these are the three important references you didn't mention, consider them. A reference optimizer. We call it. We have a collaboration tool. You can invite authors. You can open and restrict accesses in various ways. You can discuss. You can change. You have a very detailed record of the paper as it's written. All the different versions of the paper are all recorded, and things, all the comments of everybody are there to be viewed by the group of co-authors when necessary, I think. And then we have an easy way to send it to publishers. So you can send it to any journal that you want. We don't stop that. And we have all the formats, and we working on some ways to make it easy to send a paper to the journal. But we also have a one-click publishing to F1000 Research, our new journal. You're ready to do that. You choose that, you choose referees, and the paper is published within a few days. We need your participation, we need support. For us to win, we need 2 things. We need authors to stop being afraid and do what they think is right for science and right for you. We need to defeat impact factor. It's not going to be easy. That can only be done by major bodies, by governments, by things. I've just been told that apparently Australia is considering banning impact factor country-wise. Nobody's going to be allowed to mention impact factor in any job interview. You will not be able to, listed journal names will not be in there. You'll not be allowed to mention in which journal things are published. Harold Varmo said that they are planning in NIH now not to give citations, but ask authors to say what they found. So they take short description of what they found, not citation from a paper, and that will be the beginning of a consideration. So somehow impact factor needs to be we need the participation of those bodies and we need the participation of you. We determined to fight and we determined to win and we patient and we took us 10 years to do open access. This might take us 10 years. I think all of you will find the workspace fantastic. This completely changes the routine of writing, and all of you write, and all of you to know that it's a real hustle. This is a major jump forward in that world. I think anybody who ever published in F1000 Research tends to publish again. Alain published in F1000 Research. Was it okay?
No,
it is.
No.
Well, you could. Why not? I mean, you are fearless. We all know. So that's what it is, and I think the solution is possible. We are out there. Thank you for listening. This is me.